Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the media strategy of the Islamic State in terms of their displays of brutality on television and their choice of sites for executions that have significance in end-of-times Islamic prophecies. An expert on the Arab media, Marwan Kredi, the chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture at the Annenberg School of Communication and a fellow at the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study, joins us to discuss the obvious attempts by the jihadists to bait the US and the West into sending troops into Islamic lands for an apocalyptic showdown, and whether the disciplined ritual of mass slaughter they just conducted will recruit more fighters or turn off the larger Muslim audience. Then, with the re-election of Nancy Pelosi as the top Democrat in the House, following the worst rout of the Democrats in recent history, where they now have their lowest numbers in the House since World War II, we will speak with a longtime senior House and Senate staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We will discuss how the Democrats could possibly revive their fortunes and whether the Tea Party will drag the Republicans back into an intra-party fratricide resulting in another government shutdown. Then finally, we'll examine the flagrant criminality and corruption inside of FIFA, the governing body of the Soccer World Cup, whose recent internal report investigating payoffs from Russia and Qatar to get the World Cup tournaments in 2018 and 2022 were declared a clean bill of health and case closed by FIFA's controversial head, Sepp Blatter, even as the author of the report declared it contained numerous materially incomplete and erroneous representations of facts and conclusions. The only reporter banned from Sepp Blatter's press conferences, investigative journalist Andrew Jennings, the author of Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family, joins us to discuss the possibility of the German Football League and the English Football Association uniting to boycott the next World Cup. And joining us now is Marwan Kredi, who is the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Hybridity or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. He is now a fellow at the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study, and we are reaching him in the Netherlands. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Kredi.
It's my pleasure, Ian Masters. Thank you.
And why do you think the Islamic State films its hostage beheadings? What's the logic behind what they do? Obviously, they seem to be trying, at least to my mind, they seem to be trying to bait the West. And so far they have, by getting the U.S. back into Iraq for a third time. So is that their primary purpose, to sort of hope that they are outrageous enough that we swallow their bait and bring our boots back on the ground in Islamic lands?
I believe their goal is to pull the West and the United States especially into face-to-face combat. But I think these videos in general play two basic roles before baiting the West. The first one, of course, is to strike fear in the enemy. These are gruesome. They are very, very frightening visuals. And so they do achieve that objective quite well. The second goal, of course, is recruitment. You have young men, especially, who have maybe who harbor some fanatic inclinations, some outlaw proclivities. They can go to Syria and Iraq, live as outlaws, have weapons, have women, have drugs. And so these are, at a very basic level, I think, very important objectives of these videos. But as you said, in the latest video, it's very, very clear that one of the objectives of ISIS is to bait the West, especially the Obama administration, into putting boots on the ground in Iraq and in Syria. ISIS relishes the idea because this will really make all their dreams come true. And if you watch the video to its end, it's very direct. There's a very direct challenge to Obama. say you lied that your troops have left. Some troops have hidden behind your proxies, and all of this is in English with a British accent, the famous Jihadi John, who we've seen in other videos. And not only have you lied by not revealing that you have left troops behind, but you will be sending more troops very soon, and we relish the moment we're waiting for you.
So in terms of choosing the site for this latest atrocity, which is the small Syrian town of Debik on the Turkish border, apparently there's an apocalyptic prophecy that ties that site to an end of times showdown between Muslims and their enemies. The Prophet Muhammad is believed to have said that, quoting, "The last hour will not come until Muslims vanquish the Romans at Debik or Al-Amakh." So,
absolutely.
Go ahead and explain to us why that was chosen and what the propaganda significance of that is.
So at the kind of a religious doctrinal level, this is significant because the town of Debik featured in one of the hadiths of the prophets, which are the speeches or the discourses that are a very important depository of Islamic doctrine alongside the holy book, the Quran. So Debik is important at a religious level. And ISIS clearly, you know, they have a very literal interpretation of Islamic texts. And they do believe that location will be the place where East and West will clash, where they will clash with the Westerners, with the Romans. But I think this is really a cloak on what they're really saying, which is what you mentioned before, which is a political confrontation, which is to say, we're waiting for you. We're not afraid of you. Come and fight us. If you're not chicken, come and fight us. Now, there's another thing that's very important, I think. The previous videos used to be in Raqqa, which is the Syrian city that's really the capital of the Islamic State. By moving it to Debik and by making that very obvious, because if you watch the video, they indicate the location on the upper right-hand corner. It says that it's in Debik. The upper left-hand corner has either the logo of their media wing or the banner of ISIS. And what they're really saying there is that we don't only control Raqqa, that we're becoming more and more confident in the fact that we do control territories. I do think overall the significance of the video is not only in its kind of religious undertone about Debik, which will resonate with some Muslims who believe such things, who adhere to this literal interpretation, but I think there's a more important message, which is that we are a state. We are truly a state. We are not some kind of ragtag guerrilla group that pretends to be a state. We are truly a state. And if you look at the visuals in the video, the message is reinforced over and over and over again. If you look at how ISIS men are dressed, they are dressed in regular combat fatigues. They look like a regular army. If you take away the beard, the long hair among some of them, they look like a regular army. They have standard equipment. They have standard uniforms. There is a homogeneity, a uniformity that really sends the message, we are a regular army of a regular state, of a legitimate state. That's number one. Number two, it also shows that this state, which, I mean, this video in a way announces the birth, the real birth of the state. You know, I think the beheading is the bait to attract Western global media attention. But the video is very long. It begins with the history of the, how we got to the Islamic State, the small groups, Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, so on and so forth. It continues. It shows maps that are very interesting. There's the Islamic State, but there are other states, including Rome, on the map. It's a black map. It also shows maps of the countries where we don't really recognize the countries, of the territories, of the areas, in Algeria, in Tunisia, and Libya, where people have pledged allegiance to the caliph, to ISIS. And so really what the video does, it announces we are a state, we are legitimate, and nowhere is that underlined more forcefully and more gruesomely than in the mass beheading. So this is the first video that features a mass beheading. Usually it's been one hostage who is beheaded. Here you see two dozen, maybe less, maybe 20 ISIS men. They walk. The way the video is shot is from several angles. It looks like a music video more than anything else. It's very epic. They're walking from all sides. They're picking up knives from this wooden box. They line up. You see discipline. You see uniformity. You see a script being implemented. They walk behind. They drag the hostages. All the hostages, the captives, supposedly in addition to Syrian soldiers, are dressed in black. Again, uniformity. They're prisoners of a legitimate state, not of some ragtag militia. And then they behead them en masse, all together. They put their knees on their backs. They lower them to the ground, behead them, and then we see blood all over the place. I think all of this sends a very clear message that we are a real, legitimate state, not some kind of a militia without discipline that is pretending to be a state. I think, in a way, that's the fundamental difference between this video and all the previous ones.
And again, I'm speaking with Marwan Crady, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Hybridity, or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. He's now a fellow at the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study, and we're speaking to him in the Netherlands. So, Marwan, when you mentioned earlier that the primary intention perhaps of this video is to bait the West into a fight, that was made pretty clear by the Jihadi John, the narrator, if you will, who also executes the American aid worker. He says, "Here we are burying the first American crusader in Dabiq, eagerly waiting for the remainder of your armies to arrive." So that's pretty unequivocal what he's trying to achieve there. But in terms of symbolism, how is this resonating amongst Muslims, the idea of the choice of Dabiq because of its significance in history, going back to the Romans, and also the flag itself, the black flag, after all, has the same inscription that the flag of Saudi Arabia has. So how are those kind of symbols resonating?
Well, I mean, clearly in the case of this video, it's very early to tell. But we do know that, you know, that if anecdotally, if you observe the chatter on Twitter, places like that, the kind of the darker corners of the internet, among what looks to be a fringe element enthusiastic about ISIS, about militant jihadism, there is excitement. But also we've had surveys that are showing that, in fact, support for ISIS is not as large as you would think. One of the examples in the last couple of days is that in Lebanon, for instance, among the Sunnis, and as you know, Lebanon is kind of next on the agenda of ISIS after Syria and Iraq, among Sunnis, the Sunnis of Lebanon, support for ISIS is around 1%. So I think that could explain why they're becoming even more gruesome, right? They don't, I mean, we do know that when airstrikes started against ISIS, there was a flood of recruits. We do know that, for instance, the French president is concerned. The French have made very strong public statements about there's now about more than 1,000 French fighters in with ISIS. But to know exactly how this is resonating, it is too early to tell. I'm sure it is resonating positively with the fringe element, but I do feel that among the larger population of Muslims around the world, this is more repulsive than attractive.
But Turkey plays a very ambivalent role here. First of all, Turkey in many ways enabled the growth of ISIS and al-Nusra by essentially opening their borders and giving safe passage. They initially encouraged the rebellion against Assad, but like the United States, they basically did very little, except in Turkey's case and Saudi Arabia's case, just opening the floodgates and having all of these jihadists come in. They've essentially hijacked the revolution. Turkey, how's Turkish media and this president seems to be, he was very reluctant to help the Kurds out when they were under siege in Kobani by the Islamic State. So do you have any idea of how this is all playing in Turkey? And my understanding is that of the foreign fighters in the Islamic State, I think Turkey has the biggest contingency.
Turkey is in a very difficult position. The debate in the Turkish media, I don't speak Turkish, so I follow it in English language Turkish media and Arabic language Turkish media, because they do have some Arabic language media, is the paradox. They are worried that in this vast area the size of a small country itself, the size of actually of a medium-sized country that ISIS controls between Iraq and Syria, this lawless area, if they're very worried that the fall of ISIS may mean the rise of the PKK, the Kurdish militia that Turkey is extremely worried about. And they see this as a zero-sum game. They worry that if ISIS gets too weak too quickly, the PKK will get too strong too quickly. And if there's anything that the Turks worry more about than a bunch of Islamic fanatics on their borders or within the country, that would be a bunch of Kurdish militiamen on the border of Turkey and within Turkey. So I think this is the big issue. The big issue for the Turks, they look at all of this through the prism of the Kurdish issue.
Well, of course, there was a recent...
Go
ahead.
No, and if you remember the kind of the waffling and the flip-flopping during the battle of Kobani, which is situated very close to the Turkish border, again, it's because Turkey had to decide, you know, do we let Kurdish fighters in? Which is more costly, that ISIS controls Kobani or that the Kurds control the town? And so they feel that the crisis really endangered their own domestic security. There were some demonstrations in Kurdish provinces in Turkey. So they're very worried about the issue. And I think this is why they seem to be playing both sides.
So in terms of the other country that has provided most of the foreign fighters to the Islamic State, that's Saudi Arabia. They've backed off somewhat. What are you seeing, Marwan Khairy, in the Arab media about the succession to King Abdullah, who's very ill at the moment? He's 90 years old. The crown prince that's already been anointed to succeed him, Salman, he apparently has dementia, Alzheimer's. So he's not likely to make it. And the second crown prince, I suppose he's the next in line. But there's also talk that the grandchildren, the princes, these are the last of what they call the Sedaris brothers, the sons of the favorite wife of Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia. So there's a generational thing happening there, and it's probably going to be a succession crisis because one of the princes who's a half-brother is likely to challenge as well. So is there any rumblings in the Arab press about the idea that the leadership in Saudi Arabia might lead to some kind of internal struggle?
In the Arab press, per se, about the Saudi succession. As you said, there's a huge generational tension because the youngest son of the founder of Saudi Arabia, of the modern state of Saudi Arabia, is in his 60s. The next generation, there are a couple of favorites. One of them is the son of the current king, who's head of the National Guard with the rank of minister. Another one is the son of the previous crown prince, who's minister of the interior. But I can tell you this, and this is related. Number one, Saudi Arabia executed people, I believe today, maybe yesterday, who pledged allegiance to Baghdadi. So they're taking the ISIS threat very seriously, especially that the latest ISIS propaganda has been hitting Saudi Arabia directly. Number two, the other big piece of news here is that there seems to have been a Gulf reconciliation. As you know, Qatar had been playing the kind of black sheep of the Gulf Cooperation Council. Yesterday there was a meeting, a surprise summit. It's not the official summit, which is coming up in weeks, but it's a surprise summit. And what you saw there is an ailing Saudi king sitting on his chair, on his very luxurious chair, and the leaders of the other countries coming and kissing him, paying respect and sitting at the table. At the conclusion of the summit, the Emir of Qatar announced there was a pledge made by the Qataris that they will change their policies. They will stop the so-called media campaign, which means really Al Jazeera, against Egypt. Also, it's understood against Saudi Arabia. And so there are some movements. And what I think will be happening very soon is that you will see a stronger alignment of the Arab media sector alongside Saudi foreign policies, which are now in sync with Egypt. So there's, you know, what we call the counter-revolution a year or two ago seems to be proceeding very fast.
Well, Marwan Khairy, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I'm speaking with Marwan Crady, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair of, who is the Anthony let me do it again. Again, I've been speaking with Marwan Crady, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Hybridity, or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. He's also a fellow at the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Studies, and we reached him in the Netherlands. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether the Democrats could possibly revive their fortunes in the House and whether the Tea Party will drag the Republicans back into intra-party fratricide, resulting in another government shutdown. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He is the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and The Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here once again.
And Mike, in spite of the devastating results of the midterms for the Democrats, who now have their lowest number of seats in the House since World War II, nevertheless, they just reelected Nancy Pelosi unanimously to her post as the top Democrat in the House on Tuesday. Recently, in an interview she did with the Washington Post, Nancy Pelosi sounded as if the Democrats had actually won the last election. She's quoting her, she said, "Well, we did have 25 seats in play, and we've won 13 or 14 of them. We've won a majority of those seats." And then picking up the quote later, "They won 10, we won about 14. Of them, of course, no one likes to see their colleagues leave, and you don't want to lose. But of those 25 races, we won 14 and lost 10. I mean, what is she talking about?
Well, I think she sounds delusional there. I can't really understand it. Now, one thing to point out about the election, it had the lowest turnout since 1942. That was in the middle of a war, and there was no real provision for millions of servicemen who were either overseas or in training camps to vote. So that's understandable. Now we had the lowest turnout since then, but somehow or other the GOP turned out their voters. Why is it that some senior citizen who listens to Rush Limbaugh finds it worth voting, and younger people with, say, student loan debt don't bother to come to the polls? Could there be something wrong with the Democrats that they just can't induce people to go to the polls and vote?
Well, maybe they don't have any policies that they're at least enunciating to attract people, particularly young people. I mean, all that to most people ever hear from the Democratic Party are solicitations for money. And one of the things that I find extraordinary about how brain-dead the party machinery is that they don't, embrace all of these young people, in this, particularly these millennials,
who are the first generation that are indebted before they even get a job. And many of them are carrying so much student debt that they're not lucky to get a job. And they're basically, you know, impoverished for life. But they're educated, they got energy, they got ideas, they could be mobilized. But all the Democrats seem to want from their, voters is give us some money for the next run.
Well, it's not just money in that factor. It's also that it's pretty hard to inveigh against student loan debt and the trap it creates for people. When you yourself are beholden to financial services companies for a good chunk of your campaign finances, there's that. And then there's also Republicans are proudly ideological. They call it being principled, whereas Democrats now have this fetish for being these sort of post-ideological technocratic problem solvers, and they don't want to go near anything that sounds like a principled stand. It appears to have very limited appeal except to op-ed writers and groups like No Labels, which don't exactly, you know, have a huge following. Now, you can look at Virginia as an example in the last election. Ed Gillespie, the Republican, was a lobbyist on behalf of Enron in his career, and his firm, Quinn and Gillespie, represented a West African dictator who's now awaiting trial for crimes against humanity. Yet he nearly won against Mark Warner, you know, despite the fact that Warner has a generally good record. But Warner makes a point of being this non-ideological, technocratic problem solver, and it just doesn't resonate with people looking for principles.
So do you think, though, that one of the problems that the Democrats have is, and the administration certainly took the lead in this argument, is that we have an economic recovery, that we brought the economy back. And frankly, you know, the jobs may be back, but the wages aren't. And the people know that. They know that. They know. They open their paycheck. They know that they're not. They haven't had a raise since the late 1970s, for God's sake.
That's absolutely right. Behind all the news of the stock market going up, it's doubled. It's more than doubled since March of 2009, shortly after Obama came in. Unemployment's better than many places in the developed world, but people know those jobs just are not paying them very well, and that in fact most of the wealth that's being generated is sucked into, you know, stock buybacks, corporate inversions where the corporations register overseas to avoid U.S. taxation, and things like that. It's not going in terms of wage increases, despite the American worker being very productive, and you'd think he'd get at least a portion of those productivity increases. So something's definitely wrong.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. So I think the takeaway, certainly from the midterms, would indicate that the Democrats have become useless, they didn't have a message. They ran away from their president, Obama. The most flagrant example of that was, of course, Alison Grimes in Kentucky, who refused to answer the simple question did she vote for Obama, because she didn't want to be tied to Obama. But then she ran away from Obama and from Obamacare, which is incredibly popular in Kentucky, so much so that Mitch McConnell, the incumbent, now headed to be the majority leader in the Senate, he even campaigned on Obamacare in Kentucky, saying, I'll get rid of Obamacare, but I won't get rid of it in Kentucky, which, of course, is a lie. So that to me is one of the takeaways from this last election is how could they be that stupid, one, not to answer a simple question honestly, which would indicate if they can't answer a simple question honestly, how could they ever answer a complicated one? And two, why did they run away from Obama?
Well, you know, not to either praise or condemn Obama, he can stand on his own merits, but when a party runs away from its incumbent president and party leader, it's a sign of political bankruptcy. They're not going to do well, and you can only explain these losses by the sixth-year syndrome of, you know, the sixth year in the president's two terms. That only explains so much. And related to that, because we're talking about Grimes, we're talking about Mark Warner, and so forth, the candidates who ran away from the president the furthest and the fastest, to the point of being Republicans light, were the Southern Democrats. And they got clobbered. I don't know what the answer is. I'm not sure to that conundrum. But the Democrats had maybe better hire some smart analyst like Nate Silver and ask him straight out, should they write off the South for the short and medium term? Because they're certainly not doing very well there. And the national message, even if they came up with one, I doubt would resonate there very well. So they've got a serious problem. And again, on the point of my book, I wrote a new introduction to it shortly after the 2012 presidential election, saying that Democrats should not be congratulating themselves on the victory and saying that it proves the imminent demise of the Republican Party and all that sort of thing. This notion that all they have to do is lean on demographic trends to win is, I think, we've proved a false one. And certainly in the House, there's really nothing much they can do in terms of demographics until the election of 2022. In other words, the first election after the 2000 census. Or 2020 census.
So, Mike Lofgren, they seem to be thinking and talking as the Democrats that they got a good chance in 2016 because more Democrats show up for for presidential election cycles. And at this point, the landscape for 2016 is perhaps the most depressing it's ever been in American history, in the sense that it's likely to be a Clinton versus a Bush, which really makes one question whether or not we have some kind of dynastic problem here with our politics.
Well, it does make one consider on the morning after the election, inquiring with the consulate of New Zealand about immigration status there. It is really depressing, and I think Democrats underestimate the sheer inertia of Hillary fatigue, because she's been around in national public life since about 1992, and people may be getting tired of that. I mean, she's not exactly the freshest face in the Democratic Party. And counting on the fact that, well, she's a woman and women are going to turn out, that could be fallacious.
So, and you've just pointed out, of course, that until the 2020 census, the Democrats don't have a chance to undo the gerrymandering, which is why the Republicans have such a majority in the House, because they've rigged it so much in their favor. They actually get less votes than the Democrats do, but they have more seats. And you do have this rural-urban divide in this country. And there's nothing more graphic, I think, than the maps that came out of this last election to see how much of the country is red yet there are all these pockets of blue in the cities. So that seems to be the American divide between the urban Democrats and the rural Republicans.
Well, that's right. And it's a sobering thought for Democrats who think they're somehow the natural majority because of demographics to consider that close to two-thirds of state legislature seats are held by Republicans. I mean, that's astonishing.
Two-thirds of the legislative seats in all, and governorships too, isn't it?
And right, I think they hold now 31 of the governorships.
Right. So they have been very successful at the state level, and that's where a lot of the action is, right? Particularly if you have paralysis at the national level in Washington.
Right. People underestimate how important that is. Democrats tend to look at, because they tend to be more central government-oriented, they look to Washington. It's a dirty little secret, perhaps not even a secret anymore, that how Republicans got their power, among other things, is people came in at the grassroots. They tended to be a lot of Christian fundamentalists starting out at the school board level, you know, arguing about textbooks or this and that, and then they proceed on up to city council, then the state legislature. So they have a pretty good lock on many of these governments.
So what's happening then on the Republican side? Mitch McConnell has said that they won't shut the government down, but now he's sort of said that if Obama goes ahead and unilaterally does his health, his immigration reform through executive orders, that's going to really sour this honeymoon, which is, I think, rather fictional to begin with. And Mitch McConnell was really upset that Obama managed to make a deal with the Chinese on global warming, as though there's something wrong with being the presidents aren't allowed. I mean, that satirist Andy Borowitz had a funny piece recently saying that the Republicans are demanding that the passive Obama come back. they like being able to, you know, humiliate and bully this president. But now that he's being assertive, they can't take it, you know. So that's all to say that are we heading for another government shutdown?
Yeah, I don't know. It's again, not a good sign for the Democrats if their big hope is that the Republicans will bail them out by making a big mistake, like the government shutdown. Now, that said, Republicans are perfectly capable of doing that. There's shutdown fever, or at least a boomlet of shutdown fever that started up since the election. Now, if they were really Machiavellian, that say anything done by executive order can be undone by executive order and make it a 2016 campaign issue rather than shutting down the government and having that onus on them coming into the 2016 campaign. But again, I'm not their strategist. I'm just looking at this from afar.
But is there likely to be a collision in the sense that they've been dysfunctional for some time because the squeaky wheel gets the oil, and that is the Tea Party caucus? They seem to intimidate the leadership more often than not. And most of the pundits are saying, oh, well, they elected a bunch of more, you know, electable Republicans, not the crazy Tea Party candidates this time. So this is a victory for traditional Republicans. But as far as I know, traditional Republicans are an extinct species. The Rockefeller.
I don't think they were any more moderate than the other ones. They just had better message discipline. I think after 2012 and the Todd Akin fiasco, presumably Republican consultants went to these candidates and drilled into their heads, don't say what you really think, just read these lines.
Well, Mike Lofgren, I thank you for joining us here today.
Enjoyed being here.
I did too. Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lufkin, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the internal report on corruption inside of FIFA, while the head of FIFA, Sepp Blatter, has declared the matter case closed. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is Andrew Jennings, an investigative reporter, best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging, and Ticket Scandals, and his latest, Omuerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Jennings.
Hello, Ian.
And Andrew, in Tuesday's New York Times, there's an editorial titled FIFA's Farcical Shady Behavior. And the editorial basically says that FIFA's publishing the summary of an investigative report on Thursday, largely clearing Russia and Qatar for corruption in their bids to host the 2018 and the 2022 World Cup tournaments, is totally farcical. And FIFA said it welcomed the fact that a degree of closure has been reached, when the author of the report, Michael Garcia, a former United States attorney, disavowed the report, saying that it contained numerous material, incomplete and erroneous representations of the facts and conclusions. So what are we to make of that?
What you make of that is that in many respects, the New York Times has been and is a great newspaper with great reporters and courage and bravery. And on the subject of FIFA, they don't know what they're talking about because they won't read documents. The fact about Garcia is he signed up to do a confidential report. He signed up under the FIFA ethics code, and stop laughing, they do have one written by Sepp Blatter. And it says that the investigator's report cannot be published. So when he says, I think my report ought to be published, he knows it can't be. Because people are saying, well, you should leak it. Imagine, he's a commercial lawyer. If he leaks a document about a client, then his law firm is going down the proverbial, isn't it? The reality is that he was chosen very, very carefully. And if I could refer you to a bigger brain than mine, an American very big brain, and that is Professor Scott Horton of Columbia University. And the other year, when Garcia was hired, he said, and I think this says it all, the one thing that could be predicted with utter confidence on the basis of Garcia's professional career is that he would zealously protect whoever appointed him and paid his bills. He might actually go after corrupt figures, but only to the extent it served the agenda of the person who appointed him. Now, I think that's pretty devastating, and I think you know Professor Scott Horton. He is a fine brain. He knows what he's talking about. Garcia is a bit of a hustling cop who saw a lot of money in private practice. You have to look at the sequence of events with Garcia and FIFA. Garcia submitted what we can be quite sure was a whitewash. At the beginning of September, Michael Garcia submitted a report to FIFA, or to its so-called adjudicatory chamber. Really, they're a bunch of clowns. He runs the investigatory chamber, and a German lawyer runs the adjudicatory chamber. We're only talking about football, for God's sake, but it's to baffle the journalists, you see. So he puts this report in. He knows that Blatter doesn't want the people around him named for taking money from countries bidding to host the World Cup. So everything's fine. He puts a report in, clears everybody, and he knows it's buried. It's never going to come out. Takes the money, whoopee. And then the most dreadful things happen. That tabloid newspaper, the New York Daily News, published that former top man at FIFA, Chuck Blazer, the American, on the executive board at FIFA, was a cooperating witness. Oh, my God. That means the feds are going to indict, almost certainly. If they indict anybody, Garcia looks like the biggest twit there ever was. You couldn't get it. Top-notch New York prosecutor. And you couldn't get the fact that they've been doing things at FIFA, naughty things. So it's got very exciting. And so this rather boring German judge, Judge Eckert, produces his summary, which I'm sure is exactly what Garcia said. Garcia now says, it wasn't. I didn't say that. It's all wrong. But I can't publish it. No need to publish it, but this guy's misrepresenting me. Oh, really? I don't believe a word of it. But it's great stuff for the reporters. We love conflict, don't we? Mr. A attacks Mr. B, who attacks back, and in the background is Mr. C, and he's not very happy. It's great for journalists. Unfortunately, it's not very good for the truth. So we're now in a position where they can't publish the report that's cost millions and millions of dollars. Garcia is sitting there hoping that nobody leaks it. I don't think it will. It's a very small world, FIFA. And it's funny. They're so corrupt at FIFA. And let's be clear about something. The reporters keep saying, well, this is about whether Qatar or Russia paid bribes. No, it isn't. It's about whether the greedy, dirty old men at the top of FIFA around Sepp Blatter took money from those countries. There's a significant difference. There has to be, as you know, there are two parties to a bribery scam, the ones who give and the ones who take. And this report has not looked at the ones who take. And as a rather tedious history of historian of FIFA corruption, I can tell you that always, always money has been paid to get the World Cup. What's new?
But nevertheless, in spite of what you told us, Andrew, at least the New York Times is trying to keep this story alive. Even if the facts haven't come out, there's a little bit of smoke. We know there's a lot of fire on the inside, but Sepp Blatter is also, he's both the arsonist and the fire brigade, so he's keeping that.
Oh, yes, that's spot on. I mean, I don't want to pick a war with the New York Times. Their reporting on FIFA is embarrassing. Because they do it with sports reporters. They don't use any of the wonderful investigative reporters of that newspaper. Let me tell you something quite funny to one side on this. The CEO of the New York Times is Mr. Mark Thompson, formerly of the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. And when I was presenting documentaries about FIFA corruption for the flagship programme of the BBC, and the government tried to close it down because they thought it might cost us the World Cup, Mark was the one who said, over my dead body, and they didn't fancy that. So I don't think Mark's reading his own sports page. He's brilliant enough to read. So sadly, the New York Times could be doing a wonderful job. He's going with the flow. Oh, yeah, Garcia good. Some German fella bad, boring, and we don't really know what's going on, but something ought to happen. It's not good enough. It's poor journalism.
Well, in terms of something ought to happen, on Friday, the German football president, president of the German Football League, Reinhard Rabel, said that FIFA should publish the report and Garcia's bill of indictment, so it becomes clear what the charges were and how they will be judged. And he also said that if FIFA does not come clean, then the Union of European Football Associations would consider leaving the organization. Do you take that seriously?
That's the good news, and I'm very pleased to see that. Because the German people are very powerful in world football, very respected. When Blatter wants to attack the Brits, he keeps saying to the Third World, you know, they were the colonialists, they didn't get the World Cup. It's nothing to do with Brits like me, who doesn't really follow football criticizing Blatter. So it's very good that the Germans are leading the way on this. And I think one more insult from Blatter, and the Germans will say to the rest of UEFA, which is Western European National Leagues, let's just go home, shall we? Leave him with his funny little World Cup. He can have Tanzania versus Sri Lanka if he wants. That'll really cheer up the TV networks and the big sponsors. Now, Blatter knows this, but you see, there's two problems here, Ian. One is who paid the bribes and how much did they pay. Whoops. Sorry, we're told there weren't any. Never mind. The other thing is, nobody's going to Qatar. That's not against Arabs, and it's not against Muslims. The World Cup is always in the European summer. It suits your schedule, it suits our schedule, and most of the world's. The good old boys took the money at FIFA. We don't know who paid them, but they took the money and voted to stage the World Cup in temperatures which would roast the skin off the players, roast the skin off the fans. And worse than that, any of you who know England and the Western European football countries, we have a very ingrained culture of football. It runs from what you call the fall through to the spring, and don't you dare interfere with it. Don't you say, well, sorry, chaps, we're going to stop for 2 months because some dirty old men took some money and there'll be a World Cup probably on the moon, but don't worry. We do football all through the winter in Western Europe, and anybody who tries to stop that is looking to get unpleasant things done to them in dark streets. So it isn't going to happen, and Blatter, I don't know what his game is to try and get out of Qatar. Maybe there's an awful lot of watches flying around. There always is in the Gulf of football officials. But we're not going. Nobody's going. They don't want to go. And don't try and stop our football leagues. It can't happen.
Well, also, adding to what the head of the German Football League said, Reinhard Rabel, on Friday, adding to that, on Monday on the BBC, the former chief of the English Football Association, David Bernstein, called FIFA a sort of totalitarian setup that reminded him of the old Soviet Empire. And he said that British and European soccer organizations should unite in boycotting the next World Cup.
Well, I think Bernstein's right. I think for the Brits, we've got to lobby cautiously so it doesn't look like the old colonialists trying to, you know, override all these splendid countries that don't have professional football around the world. And if they do, they're all playing in European leagues. But, yeah, we've had a Blatter sell-by date. He's 78, and he thinks he can get another 4 years by bribing voters from the developing world, as we call it. There are 209 votes. If he's got 51% of those, he's re-elected. Well, I think what you think, what President Obama thinks, and anybody you can think of doesn't matter. The sponsors are too gutless to do anything. The people who, the Federation officials that vote for Blatter, get fistfuls of World Cup tickets. They get development grants and they're audited. Hey, Sepp Blatter's a great president. So let's see. If it breaks up, it'll be very, very good for football.
Well, in terms of this investigation that hasn't seen the light of day, and then you say that's the whole point of how FIFA operates, that these reports don't ever see the light of day. And even if you've got Michael Garcia, the former U.S. attorney, disowning the report and FIFA saying that they've reached closure with the report, nobody's actually seen it, although you did mention the New York Daily News has indicated maybe there's a leak coming via them. But what the New York Times is saying here about the Russian decision is that the Russian team was absolved even though it supplied only a limited amount of documents. And its excuse was but let me just finish what the New York Times says. Its excuse was that its computers had been destroyed and that it could not recover old emails. That's like saying the dog ate my homework.
And a top cop like Garcia can't find where those have gone. Nothing is lost these days. We know it's always somewhere. You think you've erased your hard disk, it's somewhere else. Garcia didn't want to know. It's a very convenient excuse because standards of probity in public life in Russia are not all we would like them to be. Instead, the Daily News hasn't got a leak. What they've got is a leak about the FBI from Federal Plaza in New York. Their investigation where they've got Chuck Blazer, former FIFA executive, he's from New York, as a cooperating witness. They've got the son of one of the dirtiest officials, Jack Warner's son, Darian, is cooperating in Miami, and I think there may be one or two others, because I was talking to an FBI man in London the other night, and he said, we know about Blaze, but there's always a few others. You turn one, and you turn some more. So I think we're waiting for it to happen. Please tell the Feds to do their duty to our game, please.
Well, are you saying, though, Andrew Jennings, that the FBI has an active investigation into FIFA?
I certainly am.
And
all I would. Yeah, it was all over the Daily News. I mean, I knew about it right. 2.5 years ago because I gave the Feds the documents about Chuck Blazer, New York's Chuck Blazer, fiddling his taxes, not paying them, living under the radar, and also lots of dirty money flooding around. So they started it, and then I left it alone because the Feds don't talk, and you wait and hope they'll ring up one day and say, guess what, Andrew, we're going to make an announcement tomorrow. We've got them. You hope so. The New York Daily News got it, I think it was November the 2nd. But if you look on the Daily News, they've had another story today. They've got their front page story was this big fat crook, Chuck Blazer, is a cooperating witness. And that will send a chill not just through Sepp Blatter, but through Garcia. Because he's saying, Mr. Garcia is saying, oh, well, we can't find any evidence. And the Feds are saying, that's not in our situation. So Garcia is very worried because if the Feds indict, and there's every chance they will, and indict several FIFA's leaders over bribes involving the World Cup, Garcia is like the most stupid investigator there ever was. And one person will be cheered up, and that's probably Elliot Spitzer because he took him down.
So, and that was a very political,
wasn't it just?
Political prosecution, obviously. Garcia's a Republican. But tell me though. What I can assume from what you just told us is that the American football official with FIFA didn't declare the bribes on his taxes. The FBI got him to flip because they've got hanging something over him like a prison sentence, and now that's led to a real possibility that there'll be a real investigation of this this sewer known as FIFA.
That's right, and it's a bit annoying in a way that we Europeans, it's our game, not yours. But in fact, you guys are doing the work, so thank you. Thank you very much to clean the game up. Don't let any of them get away. And, well, you know, go on with it, you Feds. I've met some of them. I mean, they're good policemen. They're what you hope public servants would be. Have they got enough to indict? We hope so. We really hope so.
Well, Andrew Jennings, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, mate.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Jennings, who's in the UK. He's an investigative reporter, best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging, and Ticket Scandal, and his latest, Omuerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.